So it's amazing to think when in less than 500 years, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's pure teachings could become so corrupted. But that is the society, the social order that Bhaktivinoda Thakur had to work his revolutionary change upon. And he did, through his writings, through his practice, through his personal example. He changed the face of Vaishnavism, revitalized the reality of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teachings, and established them. Established them in such a way that I want to read to you a little proof of that. That was published, there was an article published in a Calcutta newspaper, Amrita Bazar Patrika, which still publishes today, to this very day, on December 6th, 1894. Now just imagine the scene I've described about the degraded condition of Vaishnavism, then apply the revolutionary work of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and this is the result. The birthplace, the original birthplace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had been discovered, and then Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who was a prime mover in that discovery, wanted to build a temple there. And so his presence, his qualifications, impressed this newspaper to the point where they wrote the following. Babu Kedarnath Dutt, the distinguished deputy magistrate who just retired from service, is one of the most active members. Indeed, Babu Kedarnath Dutt has been deputed by his committee to raise subscriptions in Calcutta and elsewhere, and is determined to go from house to house if necessary and beg a rupee from each Hindu gentleman for the noble purpose. If Babu Kedarnath Dutt sticks with his resolution of going around with a bag in hand, we hope that no Hindu gentleman whose house may be honored by the presence of such a devout bhakta as Babu Kedarnath will send him away without contributing his mite, however humble it may be, to the Gaura Vishnupriya Temple Fund. So here is a respectable newspaper in Calcutta advising every Hindu gentleman to give for this temple that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was trying to, that Bhaktivinoda Thakur was trying to build. Such a change from a Hindu gentleman not wanting to have anything to do with a degraded Vaishnava tradition. So that was his revolutionary contribution. And then today is also the disappearance of Haridas Thakur. What do we find of his contribution? Well, what do you think? What was revolutionary about Haridas Thakur? Can anybody say?
His faith in the holy name.
Well, that's always revolutionary, something special.
He's born in a Muslim
family. He's Nam Acharya, but he's born in a Muslim family. Namacharya means, we're talking the Hindu religion, so-called, thinking like that at least. But he's Namacharya, he's a teacher of the Yuga Dharma, chanting the holy name of the Lord, but he's born in a Muslim family. Think how that challenges the local society that he appeared in. Think how that challenged it. So greatly that so many Brahmins and things, they had encounters with Haridas Thakur. Who are you? Why can you say this? But on the basis of his purity, his humility, and his strong faith in the holy name, he was able to change the conception so that today, all of us sitting here can say that yes, we can be considered devotees of the Lord, practicing Vaishnavas, because Haridas Thakur opened the door. He opened the door for all of us. No one can say, anyone around the world cannot be a Vaishnava, when Namacharya Haridas Thakur, born in a Muslim family, served in that capacity in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission. So truly revolutionary contributions that were made. And there's a theme that runs through all of them that I want to go back to Vamandev to speak about, or to read to you something about. Because there is a core in the teachings that make the difference. And so there's some advice that Vamandev gives to Bali Maharaj. Let's see here. Okay. There's some advice that Vamandev gives to Bali Maharaj. You see, Vamandev, his plan was to win back everything from Bali Maharaj, who was a daitya or a demon king, to win it back and give it back to the rightful owners, the demigods. He chose to appear as a small dwarf, and he appeared before Bali Maharaj and he asked him for 3 paces of land, according to his own foot measurement. Now, he's a dwarf Brahmin, so his foot measurement is not very big. But he asked him according to that measurement. And Bali Maharaj, who was the Lord and Master of the entire universe, thought, well, there's something, this boy is a little inexperienced, immature, he doesn't know what to ask for. And so he said to him, I can give you everything. Why are you asking just 3 paces of land? Don't be foolish. Take advantage of this offer. And would all of, what would we do? What would we do? We're sitting before the Master of the universe, who can give us anything we want. We might be tempted to ask for who knows what. Let's not think what. But here's what Vamandev said. And this is the core of the revolutionary spirit that made all those changes we just talked about. Here's what he replied to Bali Maharaj when he said, I can give you everything. The personality of Godhead said, my dear king, even the entirety of whatever there may be within the 3 worlds to satisfy one's senses cannot satisfy a person whose senses are uncontrolled. If I am not satisfied with 3 paces of land, then surely I will not be satisfied even with possessing one of the 7 islands consisting of 9 varshas. Even if I possessed 1 island, I would hope to get others. We have heard that although powerful kings like Maharaj Prithu and Maharaj Gaya achieved proprietorship over the 7 dvipas, they could not achieve satisfaction or find the end of their ambitions. One should be satisfied with whatever he achieves by his previous destiny, for discontent can never bring happiness. A person who is not self-controlled will not be happy even with possessing the 3 worlds. Material existence causes discontent in regard to fulfilling one's lusty desires and achieving more and more money. This is the cause of the continuation of material life, which is full of repeated birth and death. But if one is satisfied with that which is obtained by destiny, is fit for liberation from this material world. A Brahmana who is satisfied with whatever is providentially obtained is increasingly enlightened with spiritual power, but the spiritual potency of a dissatisfied Brahman decreases as fire diminishes in potency when water is sprinkled upon it. Therefore, O King, for you, the best of those who give charity, I ask only 3 paces of land. By such a gift, I am very pleased, for the way of happiness is to be fully satisfied to receive that which is absolutely needed. These words, spoken millennium and millennium ago, ring true in our society today. Everyone is trying to be satisfied in different ways, and the general thought of how to do that is to accumulate more and more and more, to be very aggressive and contentious in one's attempt to gain more and more and more. If you don't, you'll lose. you'll be left behind. Intense competition characterizes even the placement of children in preschool situations. And so that's what our civilization is based on at present. And these words of Vamandev challenge that, challenge it in ways which have to be answered, have to be accounted for. And so the revolutionary teachings of all those persons we talked about before, Jiva Goswami, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Haridas Thakur, they're all based on this idea. How to change our material condition in life so that it becomes favorable for the execution of spiritual life. So these two things characterize the revolution that took place just short of 50 years ago on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. There, an elderly Indian gentleman, actually he was a saint, who was alone, who had no money, no friends, no other resources, created a revolution that we all benefit from today. Is down there? So who was that? Srila Prabhupada ki. Srila Prabhupada actually himself, and this is the other note that we'll make on the Vaishnava calendar. Tomorrow is the anniversary of Srila Prabhupada's acceptance of the sannyas order in life. And so his willingness to sacrifice for us and be the lead person in the revolution that's taking place right now, here and now, in Western civilization is very significant. Prabhupada predicted, actually, in 1977, he said that when historians in the future look back, they'll look to this period, talking about the period in which he was giving his teachings, his example, enacting his revolutionary behavior. They'll look back, Prabhupada said, to this period as to where the change in society took place, where the revolution took place. He said that the change would be a historical renaissance. We all know the Renaissance took place in Europe. Historically, it took place after the Dark Ages. Then there was a Renaissance. Dark Ages, people were simply interested in surviving. That's all they could do. Eating, sleeping, mating, and defending was what life was all about. But then there was a Renaissance. Unfortunately, it wasn't a spiritual Renaissance, but at least people got out of the simple, the drudgery of life and realized that there was more to life. The Prabhupada said there'll be a historical renaissance when people look back on this period, because in this period, these teachings that Vamandev, that I just read from Lord Vamandev, and that are echoed by Srila Jiva Goswami, Haridas Thakur, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, this is where those things took root and started to grow. They took root and started to grow. Therefore, Prabhupada said they'll look back to this period. Now, you may say that, well, you know, you're pretty bold up there claiming, you know, the change in society is all based on Prabhupada and Hare Krishna and everything. What's your proof? Well, there is proof. There is proof that there's change happening. And it's based in three things that Srila Prabhupada used as main focal points for his preaching here in the West. First, we are eternal spiritual beings, not this material body, who have life beyond the present body. That is a revolutionary idea. We are not this material body. And there, we have a life beyond just the temporary existence of this mortal frame. Number two, civilization based on cruelty, i.e. animal slaughter, is conducive neither to peace and prosperity nor to awakening our spiritual nature. The two don't go together. You cannot maintain mass slaughter of millions and millions and millions of animals every year and expect peace and prosperity in society. It doesn't work like that. And third point, science and technological advancement will never make us happy. Prabhupada hammered on these three points. Prabhupada hammered on these three points as centerpieces of his revolutionary presentation of Krishna consciousness. He had some effect. He had a lot of effect. So let's just go over what that effect was a little bit. Number one, we are spiritual beings, not this material body. If you accept that principle in your life, it has to change what you do every day. It has to change what you do every day. Because it's not all over at the end of the body. That's what people think today. And therefore, they dare to do so many things because they think, well, I'm not going to be held accountable. Christianity, which holds that principle, and rightly so, is good in that regard. Unfortunately, it's kind of diminishing around the world, particularly in Western civilization. I'm told by my sannyasi godbrothers who preach in Europe that essentially Christianity is dead in Europe. Even though they have this valuable teaching. So Srila Prabhupada is reviving something that even they can appreciate. That there are consequences to our actions and they go beyond just this body. And if we think like that, we have to change what we're doing. If we understand we're all spiritual beings, we're not different from one another, then so much strife that's there in the world immediately becomes reduced. I remember growing up in the United States, understanding the race problem, black and white. But then when I got a little older and I started looking around the world, everywhere I looked, I could see, well, everywhere there are different people and there's always something that's keeping them at odds. One of my first remembrance, first knowledge of Guyana, where I used to be the GBC and go and preach, was that there were sort of like riots and fighting between the black villages and the Hindu, the Indian villages of their people there. So there's no black and white there, but there's something else to keep people fighting. In Northern Ireland, Irish and the Catholics and the Protestants fighting there again, a dichotomy in India, Hindu-Muslim. There's always something that we think is that we're different from somebody else and therefore it ends up in fighting. If we understand we're spiritual beings beyond the body, then these differences don't become life and death matters like they do when we just consider the body. So revolutionary change can be there in society. We understand this principle that we're not the spiritual body, not this body, and that we have a life beyond this body. Now, of course, there's a lot more in spiritual advancement that's there. But if just this basic point is made and accepted, then society changes in revolutionary ways. Civilization based on cruelty. Someone has to pay if there's the slightest harm done to somebody. Say I walk out of here and I punch somebody. Somebody can call the cops and say, hey, this guy hit me, and they'll take me away. A little harm was done, and somebody has to pay. Does nobody have to pay for the millions and millions of animals that are slaughtered in this country every year? Does nobody have to pay? Prabhupada, with his transcendental vision, indicated that the cause of war, a cause of war, is this senseless killing of animals, just on the pretense that it's healthy to eat. Of course, that's changing as well. 2 years ago, the New York Times, who has published 256 articles about vegetarianism since 1983. And that after, in 1903, publishing that vegetarianism was a silly fad. They've changed because they understand that eating meat is not healthy, and how you get that meat on your plate is worse. If we give up eating meat and this cruelty-based civilization, the world will change, and the world is changing. Finally, science and technology. The promise is there. Prabhupada called it a blank check or post-dated check. Give us money and we'll cure this disease. Give us money and we'll make you happy. In my law practice, I work with scientific researchers. And so in the course of preparing a case, I was doing some research on cancer research and the effectiveness of cancer research. And I came across very credible, not, you know, these kind of wacko, kind of far-out guys commenting, but credible mainstream people claiming that cancer research has not, as for the amount of money that goes into cancer research, the return in conquering cancer, they don't equate. Now, tell me if I... But no, it's true. There, he's a cancer researcher. So there's a promise that science and technology will make us happy, but it hasn't happened. Has society become more happy as more gadgets come out? New York Times, again, they did a survey several years ago called the Unplugged Challenge, where they challenged people, unplug for a week and tell us what it felt like. People were saying, I felt relief from the clock on my cell phone. I felt tangible relief that I didn't have to like see this time pressure staring at me. Many people reported, you know, feeling relieved like this in various ways. They felt like they got their life back, they got some time back, that they could relate to other people instead of just machines. Actually, there was one Indian lady named Rupa who said that, let me see her quote here. Rupa found that her internet use had become an uncontrollable impulse by which she devalued other activities that didn't involve her laptop. Being unplugged from the internet for 1 week, she experienced more focus and pleasures in other activities, and she developed a desire to more tangibly engage with the world. Now, these people aren't saying they're going to start pick up a bead bag and start chanting Hare Krishna, but the point is that these changes lay the foundation for one to have the eligibility to chant Hare Krishna. Otherwise, the mind's too distracted. Otherwise, one's life is too involved with sin. So these changes are the revolutionary underpinning the preparation for giving people the chance to chant Hare Krishna, to stop and hear the Sankirtan party, to ask questions, well, what is this all about? And to have the clear enough mind and heart to understand that, yes, well, this is something worthwhile pursuing. That revolution has to take place first. And when it does, we reach a tipping point and hundreds and thousands of people will be chanting Hare Krishna, will be taking to a God-conscious life. And that way, society will change. It must change because the present society is not fulfilling anyone's desire, any happiness. And so we celebrate the revolutionary spirit that these great acharyas have brought and that we should take advantage of and participate in ourselves, because it will revolutionize our own lives, which I know in my case is something that is needed to shake up the situation, change life. It doesn't last forever. We're not these material bodies. We have a short-term material frame, and we got to do something now, because if we don't, we may lose the opportunity. So we need to think in these kind of revolutionary ways. Now, I think that we should be ready to begin the program here at the school, which is another revolutionary effort given by our founder, Acharya. Establish a Gurukul from the very beginning, give these children the opportunity to be exposed to Krishna consciousness as the goal of life. And so we certainly want to support any endeavor that our teachers and our administrators do at our Bhaktivedanta Academy of North America. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.